Hello, adventurers. Welcome back to the next installment of the audio version of my memoir, Adventures with Postpartum Depression, which is now available on Amazon in paperback and ebook, or you can head over to my website, ppdadventures.com, and grab your download of the free ebook, which will come in any version. It goes to this company called BookFunnel, and they have great customer service, and they will set you up if you want Kindle, if you have a Nook, if you're doing it on your iPhone, whatever device works for you. I am a bit congested today, if you can't hear. I've had a head cold for a few days, but I think my voice can handle at least one chapter, if not two chapters today. My goal is still to get this done by June 2018, so just hoping my throat is up for the game. All right, so let's just get into this before I lose my voice completely. Chapter 6, the first 6 weeks. How are you doing? Wonderful. I'm doing great. I knew exactly what the obstetrician was doing. She was trying to sniff out a whiff of postpartum depression. As if on cue, Pippa started to scream. She sounded like a siren portending the world's end, but the obstetrician seemed unperturbed by the noise. Instead, she looked concerned for me. I willed myself to appear calm and collected. "But how do you feel?" she pressed. "I feel great." I was at my 6-week postpartum appointment, and given my history with hypochondria, did not want to say anything that would lead to a misdiagnosis of postpartum depression. Still, my doctor seemed to think I had it. In hindsight, I realized my appearance might have tipped her off. I usually got my long brown hair professionally cut and highlighted every 2 months. During pregnancy, my obstetrician had assured me that I could continue getting my hair highlighted, but I was not taking any chances. What if some chemicals seeped through my scalp, got into my bloodstream, and hurt my baby? If I was not getting my hair highlighted, I might as well skip the haircuts too. I had read about postpartum hair loss and reasoned it was better to have as much hair as possible in case half of it fell out. By the time my water broke, my hair was straggly and a mix of grays and faded highlights. 3 hours of active labor did nothing to improve my look. The ponytail holder fell out and my hair got tangled into a sweaty, salty mess. During my first postpartum shower, I was too tired and defeated to drag a comb through the knots. 6 weeks later, I still felt too defeated to deal with the hair situation. Eventually, I would buy a detangler and conquer the knots, but that was still several weeks away. My obstetrician must have been more than a little alarmed by my hairstyle. "Are you happy? Getting enough rest?" My hair was truly frightening. "I am doing wonderfully. I didn't even have the baby blues. I haven't cried. I've been so happy since Pippa arrived." When I said I was happy, I was trying to convince myself as much as the doctor. The part about crying, though, was true. I had not cried since Pippa's birth, aside from the one time I started crying at 1 a.m. from pure exhaustion. That didn't count. That was not the baby blues. I assumed that whether or not a new mother had the baby blues was the ultimate barometer of her mental health. That postpartum depression was an extension of the baby blues. In a few months, I'd know better. By the time of this 6-week appointment, I had postpartum depression. I had not experienced any symptoms that would get me locked up in the mental ward. Those would come soon enough. But looking back, I can see the red flags. There was my new obsession with germs. Previously, my hypochondria had always been limited to symptoms I had or thought I had, never extending into misophobia or fear of germs. Postpartum depression had helped me make the leap from hypochondria to misophobia. The first day of Pippa's life, while my parents and grandma were visiting us in the maternity ward, I scrolled through the online options for face masks. I needed a cache of masks for visitors who might arrive at my house with coughs and sneezes. "I can't tell which one is good enough. I'm sure they are all fine." That was my mom, a woman who was always vigilant about her children's health. When everyone, including the pediatrician, insisted my sister simply had the flu, my mom was the one who piled everyone into the car to go to the hospital. 3 hours later, the nurses were prepping Catherine for an emergency appendectomy. Now that her first grandchild was here, you could be sure my mom was not going to let anything endanger Pippa's health. "But even the ones that are supposed to be good enough for surgery are not 100% effective." "Courtney, if it's good enough for surgery, it will keep Pippa safe." "You don't know that." I spent another hour agonizing over the options before settling on the best bad choice. Then I fixated on my next fear, unwanted visitors. What if someone wants to visit and they are sick? My mom had Pippa stretched across her legs, face down, and was patting her back. This seemed to help her burp. "Courtney, no one is going to visit when they are sick." But what if someone wants to visit and they're already sick and contagious, but they don't have any symptoms yet? Or they think it's allergies. A cold can kill a newborn. I was imagining droves of Hennings, aunts, uncles, and cousins from my dad's side of the family descending upon our house unannounced. If the Hennings ask, do you want me to tell them you don't want visitors? Yes. Be nice about it. But if anyone asks, discourage visitors. The message must have been effectively delivered, because almost no one visited. Just my parents, Nathan's parents, my siblings, my grandma, and one cousin. I have a lot of aunts, uncles, and cousins in Los Angeles who would have loved to meet Pippa, but they steered clear. So the misophobia created another red flag behavior. Isolation. Sorry, my hands are cold. The obstetrician had opened my gown and was gently touching my abdomen. It's okay, I said. I had dozens of questions about my abdomen. Various nurses had shown me how to check my uterus and make sure it was shrinking, but their instructions made no sense. I could never tell what part of my body was stomach, what part was uterus, and what part was flab. I wanted to ask my doctor if my uterus had shrunk back to its regular size, but talking seemed like too much work. I like people. I like talking. And lately, my life had been lacking in the conversation department. I chatted with Pippa throughout the day, but so far she was a lousy conversationalist. I usually enjoyed talking with my obstetrician and should have been looking for ways to prolong the interaction. Instead, I could not wait to be alone again. When my parents and grandma visited, I usually retreated to my bedroom to sleep. I was exhausted from breastfeeding Pippa in the middle of the night, and sleep is essential to health, physical, mental, and spiritual. But even when I emerged to feed Pippa, I hated talking. It seemed like an unnecessary burden. In reality, I was turning into a people-hating hermit. Postpartum depression had changed my personality. Just the previous week, my parents, sister, and grandma had wanted to visit during the weekend. I protested. 4 visitors at the same time? That was too much stimulation for Pippa. On the phone, I told my mom that anything more than 2 was unreasonable. Okay. I imagine my mom must have taken a deep breath at this point. Just your father and sister will come. Thank you. I felt so relieved. Thank you. I have to look out for Pippa. A couple of days later, my mom called again. Would it be all right if your grandma also comes to visit this weekend? What? Grandma? She's going back to New York in a week, and she'd like to see as much of Pippa as she possibly can before she goes. I gritted my teeth. Fine. When Nathan got home from work, I exploded. This is ridiculous! They turned the house into a circus. It's too noisy and crowded with all of them here. My mom is being so manipulative. Less than 2 years earlier, the morning after our wedding, we had about 30 people over to our house for bagels and donuts. The house had not seemed too crowded or noisy then. One newborn later, I could not tolerate the idea of being visited by 3 of my favorite people in the world at the same time. People who bathed the baby, trimmed her fingernails, and brought groceries. People who whisked away the dirty laundry and brought it back clean and folded. It was not my mom who was being manipulative. It was the postpartum depression. It had manipulated me into a new person. Are you still breastfeeding? The obstetrician gently examined my chest. Over in her stroller, Pippa was still wailing. Yes, exclusively. I spent hours every day with Pippa suckling at my breast. The expert said a baby should be fed on demand, so every time she whined, I offered her a meal. Then, once she had latched on, I could never tell if she was actually eating or just using me as a pacifier, so I let her linger as long as she liked. Each meal lasted at least an hour, and since she seemed hungry every other hour, I spent approximately half the day anchored to my chair. I thought good mothers exclusively breastfed their babies. I was wrong. More on that later. But at the time of my 6-week checkup, that was what I believed. That explains why when my obstetrician asked if I was breastfeeding Pippa, and I said exclusively, my stomach heaved from guilt and anxiety. I still felt bad that we had supplemented Pippa's meals with a little formula when she was diagnosed with jaundice. I remember the sucker punch of guilt that I felt in my gut when the pediatrician reported the jaundice on day 2 of Pippa's life. The pediatrician mentioned that we needed to supplement with formula because I was not producing milk yet, and I immediately, and incorrectly, blamed myself. It was my fault that Pippa had jaundice. Pippa's jaundice was not my fault, but I had always had a propensity to feel guilty about things that were out of my control. In the 2nd grade, when my vision started to fail, I assumed I had sinned and was being punished by God. My hippie parents were not at all religious, but after becoming less than enamored with the local public school, they had sent me to Catholic school. Impressed by an Old Testament God who sent floods and leveled cities, I hid my shoddy vision for 2 years. Every time I had to take an eyesight exam at school or the doctor's office, I cheated. I got close to the Snellen chart, memorized the lower rows of letters, and bluffed my way towards 20/20 vision. By the fourth grade, though, no amount of squinting could help me decipher the blurry smudges on the chalkboard. When I finally confessed my poor vision to my mom, and she laughed and said I inherited my dad's vision, I felt as if I had escaped damnation. Guilt, though, is its own sort of damnation. And 6 weeks postpartum, I was in guilt hell. After Pippa's jaundice, guilt hijacked my body. I felt guilty when Nathan got up with Pippa during the night so I could sleep a little more. Surely he needed his sleep more than I did. I felt guilty when my smartphone died and I had to race out on a Saturday to buy a new one. Surely I should have anticipated that and procured a new phone when I was pregnant. I even felt guilty when, after holding Pippa for hours in the evening, she liked to cluster feed, I passed her to Nathan so I could go to the bathroom. My bladder should have been stronger. At 6 weeks postpartum, I had no idea that the guilt I felt was extreme or that feeling guilty is a symptom of postpartum depression. Everything looks like it has healed nicely. The obstetrician was talking about my vagina. So it's okay to have sex again? Yes, all activities are fine, including sex. My vagina had been cleared for takeoff, but I still felt sore and tender in my pelvic region. I assumed I was supposed to be excited to rejoin the ranks of the sexually active, but my vagina felt differently. After the trauma of childbirth and second-degree tears, it was going to take more than 6 weeks for my body to be ready for sex. When Nathan and I did have sex, it was painful. It became another source of anxiety. Most of the time, I worried we were not having enough sex. Then, when we were having sex, I worried the doctor had sewn me up a little too vigorously. Would I feel like a virgin forever? My poor body just needed more than 6 weeks to heal. To be more precise, my vagina needed 8 months to heal. I'm not trying to be lurid or sensational, but my thoughts on sex were another red flag. My doctor did not know how I felt. All she could see was the way my wounds had healed. Based on what she could see, my vagina was indeed ready for sex. Based on what I could feel, though, the only thing my vagina was ready for was hibernation. A very extended hibernation. I did not tell my doctor that everything was still sore in the pelvic region. That felt inappropriate. Remember, this was not just any doctor. This was my obstetrician, a professional trained to take care of vaginas. Yet I felt too embarrassed to talk about my vagina with my vagina doctor. This was new. I had never been ashamed of my female anatomy. When I needed a box of tampons and bar of chocolate from the pharmacy and nothing else, I had no problem making those purchases from a male cashier. When I needed a box of Monistat 3 and ice cream and nothing else, I had no problem purchasing those from a male cashier either. A urinary tract infection and a male doctor at the ER? I could not care less. Shame is a symptom of postpartum depression, and I was most definitely ashamed of myself. I was ashamed that my vagina had not bounced back from delivery. I was ashamed about the physical pain I felt in a very feminine part of my body, the portal for which my daughter had entered the world. This was not rational shame. This shame did not arise from something I had done wrong. It originated from the very source of my femininity. There was nothing rational about this shame, but as I would eventually learn, there is nothing rational about postpartum depression. The appointment was almost over. The doctor asked, "So are you sure you have been feeling well?" Lovely. We were back on the subject of my mental health. "Oh yes, I feel fantastic. Have you noticed any personality changes?" "Nope, I feel like me." Pippa was still crying. Why did the doctor think my mental health was so important? Obviously, I was doing fine. I just had a couple of pesky issues I wanted to address before I could stage my escape and comfort my baby. "I did want to ask you about stool softeners." "Yes, I've been taking the stool softener that the gastroenterologist recommended ever since I gave birth. Do you think I need to keep taking it?" "You should keep taking the stool softener for as long as you feel like it is necessary. But at this point, I think you can safely reduce the dose. Does that make sense?" "Yes, yes it does." "Do you have any other questions about constipation?" 6 weeks postpartum, I still worried about constipation every day. I did not ask my doctor if my concerns were a problem. Of course they were a problem. My preoccupation with constipation was a symptom of my increasing anxiety, but I did not see it that way. With my history of hypochondria, I saw my preoccupation with constipation as proof positive that I was what I had always been, a hypochondriac. I did not want my doctor to think I was a hypochondriac, so I was not about to dwell too long on the subject. I would just have to wean myself off the stool softeners and move on with my life. Besides, I had a question about something even more important than constipation. Can I ask you about my wrists? Of course! My wrists have been in agony. Could I possibly get a prescription for physical therapy? Let me take a look. My obstetrician gently touched my wrists. Does this hurt? A little. Can you describe the pain? If I have moved my wrists, it hurts. I've been using cold packs and heating pads, but it hurts to even hold a book. The doctor said that my wrists might be hurting because I had arthritis. This is where my memory gets murky. I remember clearly that she used the word arthritis, but I don't remember if she said the arthritis was related to childbirth or not. Pippa had been crying for 10 minutes now. The sound of her cries made me very uncomfortable. I'm not alone in this. Pretty much any mother will tell you that the sound of her baby cries is impossible to ignore. Scientific studies support this. But since I was at my 6-week appointment and needed to lie back on a table for the examination, I felt obligated to ignore Pippa. Besides, if I soothed her and then put her back down to finish the exam, that would just piss her off more. By the time my doctor mentioned the possibility of arthritis in my wrists, I was so agitated from ignoring Pippa's cries that I could not process any more information. The postpartum depression had also muddled my brain. Sleep deprivation was not helping either. Also, I had already asked Dr. Google about the pain in my wrists, and the internet was happy to provide stories from women who ignored the postpartum pain in their wrists and eventually needed surgery. The word arthritis coming from my doctor's mouth confirmed my worst fears. The pain in my wrists was never going to improve. My brain started to shut down. My obstetrician took several minutes to explain what might be happening with my wrists, but this was all I gleaned. It could be arthritis. Physical therapy might help. But first, I needed to get a full blood work done at the lab. Do you understand? The obstetrician had stopped explaining the wrist situation. It was my turn to talk. Apparently, I was now in possession of enough information to understand why I needed a blood test for pain in my wrists, but I was too overwhelmed to understand anything. The blood seemed to be rushing extra fast to my arteries, my lungs hurt, the room seemed smaller than ever, Pippa's screams were certainly louder, and my skin seemed to be losing elasticity and having trouble stretching over all my bones. I did not understand why my wrists hurt. I thought I had just strained some muscles lifting Pippa's infant car seat. It had never occurred to me there might be something more serious at work. I did not understand why I needed a blood test. I did not understand why breastfeeding seemed more difficult now than it had the day Pippa was born. I did not understand why other moms were able to go places with their newborns, and I had so much trouble going to one doctor's appointment. I did not understand why the doctor had asked me so many questions about my mental health. The doctor was waiting for an answer. Yes, I smiled. Yes, I understand. Chapter 7. Checking, checking, checking. 2 a.m. I was lying in bed. Nathan sound asleep to my left. Pippa sound asleep in her yellow cradle to my right. The ceiling fan whirred overhead. I was wearing my headphones, and my headphones were plugged into my iPhone, which was playing the sound of a rushing river. Circumstances were perfect for sleep. Except my wrists were throbbing. Lying in bed, I reprimanded myself. I really needed to stop clutching my smartphone during Pipple's nocturnal feedings. Except scrolling through blogs was the only thing that kept me awake. If I just watched Frasier reruns, I fell asleep. And if I fell asleep, I might drop Pippa, or worse, lean forward and suffocate her with my own body. I tried to put my wrists out of my mind. Thinking about the wrists just made me think about the ultrasound. I'd gotten the blood test, and the results had shown elevated enzyme levels in my liver. The nurse said this was probably due to weight gain during pregnancy. You think? But my obstetrician still wanted me to get an ultrasound of my liver before I could get physical therapy for the wrists. I flipped from my left side to my right. The blood test had been an ordeal. My parents had watched Pippa, and the entire time I was gone, my anxiety spiked as if I were in the middle of a natural disaster. This made no sense. Pippa was safe and happy with my parents. I had pumped a bottle of breast milk in case she got hungry. The lab was only a few miles from our house, so if there was an actual natural disaster, I could still get home. Nevertheless, I suffered. My heart pounded, my skin crawled as if I were covered by hundreds of bugs, and I generally felt as if the world were about to end. It was not. There was absolutely no reason for the way I felt. At least, there was no logical reason, but there was a biological one. Postpartum depression. Anxiety is a symptom of postpartum depression, a symptom I was experiencing with greater intensity and frequency. As I tried to get back to sleep, the thought of the ultrasound made my heart race. There were so many things that could go wrong. What if Nathan had to go to work and I had to bring Pippa to the appointment? What if I could not pump enough milk and Pippa got hungry? What if Nathan was annoyed that he had to go into work a little late because his fat wife needed an ultrasound? Those petty concerns were easier to ponder than the deeper fear. What if I had cancer? Rationally, I knew my doctor was being overly cautious. Just as she had wanted to rule out MS when I was constipated, now she wanted to rule out some serious liver condition when all I had were sore wrists. Yet I could not stop myself from worrying that I might have cancer and leave Pippa to grow up without a mother. I flipped back to my left side. I could not get comfortable. At least Pippa seemed to be comfortable in her cradle. Or was she? I tiptoed over and leaned as close as I could to her face and listened for the sound of her breathing. Her chest moved up and down, but the room was dark. Maybe my eyes had tricked me into thinking she was breathing, but she was actually in distress. I gently rested my hand on the soft spot on the top of her head where the skull had not fully closed. For a moment, I felt nothing. Trembling, I inched my hand to the left. My body relaxed as I found it, her pulse. My baby was still alive. I got back into bed and closed my eyes. My muscles relaxed, my breathing slowed, and the chatter in my brain faded. Had I checked Pippa's sleep sack? At night, Pippa slept in a sleep sack, which was like a sleeping bag with armholes. The sleep sack kept her warm without the risk of smothering her the way a blanket might. Rationally, I knew she was safe and snug in her sleep sack and told myself to go to sleep. What if I had inadvertently nudged the sleep sack out of place? What if it was on top of Pippa's mouth? What if she was suffocating this very moment? My eyes flew open. I closed them and urged myself to go to sleep. I knew Pippa was fine. These fears were ridiculous. I needed to get some decent rest before Pippa wanted to breastfeed again. Just as it seemed as if I could talk some sense into my anxiety, the guilt chimed in. Was I really placing my desire to sleep above my daughter's safety? What sort of mother was I? I got out of bed, crept toward Pippa, and examined the sleep sack's position. It was several inches away from her mouth. I went back to bed and closed my eyes. I took several deep breaths. What if, while walking back to bed, I had caused a disturbance in the air that moved the sleep sack onto Pippa's mouth? It had not always been this way. In the maternity ward, whenever Pippa was swaddled and in her cradle, I knew she was safe. Or more precisely, it never occurred to me to worry about her safety. I do not remember exactly when I started checking Pippa during the night. Those first weeks are such a blur. But I do know it was not our first night home from the hospital. That first night, I was too busy figuring out a way to get Pippa to sleep in a place other than my arms. She had slept easily in the hospital cradle, but screamed every time we put her in the travel crib in the master bedroom. Nathan and I took turns holding her. Around 1 a.m., out of desperation, I checked a baby book the pediatrician had recommended specifically for sleep issues. The book said newborns could sleep in a car seat. I eased Pippa into her car seat and slowly withdrew my hands. She slept. I rejoiced and went to sleep myself. I was too exhausted to think about her breathing. But eventually, probably when Pippa was a few weeks old, I started to worry. According to my baby books, sudden infant death syndrome claimed the lives of 1,500 infants every year in the United States. That is not actually that big a number when you consider the fact that in 2013, the year Pippa was born, there were 3.93 million births in the United States. That means for every 100 babies born in 2013, less than 0.04% of those babies died of SIDS. SIDS still terrified me. It was as if the Grim Reaper were hovering nearby, waiting to snatch Pippa while I had the audacity to slumber. I followed all the advice I could find. We kept the cradle in our bedroom, ran a fan all night, used the sleep sack. Pippa still seemed to be in imminent danger. And so I checked to make sure she was breathing, as if by checking I could ward off evil spirits or at the very least reassure my frazzled nerves. The reassurance, though, never lasted more than a few seconds. I got out of bed again, the fifth time in as many minutes. This time, after checking Pippa's pulse and watching the fall and rise of her chest, I tucked the sleep sack into her pajamas to make sure it would not get loose during the night. Now I could sleep. Except, tucking the sleep sack had created a big fabric bulge near Pippa's neck. Could that interfere with her windpipe? No, I told myself. She was fine. I had pulled the fabric bulge several inches away from her neck. But how could I be sure the fabric bulge would stay in place? I had to know. A few weeks later, once again during the middle of the night, I put my hand on the knob of the front door and turned as hard as I could, twisting back and forth until I was sure it was locked. Then I turned away to go back to bed. But was it really locked, or did it just seem to be locked? I unlocked the door, relocked it, and then rattled the knob back and forth to make sure it was really, really, really locked. I felt calm. I removed my hand from the doorknob. My heart immediately started to thump as if I were on the verge of a heart attack. Was the door really locked? After testing the lock's integrity a dozen more times, I pulled myself away like a spaceship escaping a tractor beam. At last, I could go back to sleep. I had finished breastfeeding Pippa almost an hour ago, but if I fell asleep right away, I could probably get into a REM cycle before she was awake for the day. I took a deep breath. Sleep, please let me sleep. Was the back door locked? I had checked the back door just 5 minutes ago, but maybe something had happened to unlock it. I chided myself. I was being ridiculous. But if the door was unlocked, and a kidnapper was prowling the neighborhood, the risk was too high. After checking the back door, I could not resist the urge to revisit the front door again, because you never know. On my way back to bed, I walked through the kitchen. When was the last time I checked the stovetop burner? If you place a frog in a pot of boiling water, it will leap to safety. It is said that if you place the same frog in a pot of room temperature water and flick on a flame, it will not notice the change in temperature. This is not actually true. Still, I like the metaphor. Even when the water has started to boil, the frog will stay in the pot, oblivious that it is being cooked alive. I was the frog. I staggered toward bed, half assured that the doors were locked and stovetop burners lit. What about the windows? I started in the kitchen, yanking upward on each window. Then I moved to the living room. I could see with my eyes that the windows were, in fact, locked. Or maybe they only looked that way. I pulled as hard as I could on the first window. It did not budge. I turned and considered the second. A huge, thorny bougainvillea grew in front of that window. Not even Prince Charming could get through those tangles. The window was completely inaccessible. Yet I could not resist. I had to check. Next, I went to the nursery and checked the windows by the changing table. Then it was time to survey the guest room. But wait, there was a window in the nursery closet. The old owners had sealed that window shut, and it was impossible to open. Besides, it was no bigger than a shoebox. No one could climb through it. I had to know. I opened the closet door, leaned over diaper boxes, and strained at the window as if the house were on fire and this window were the only way out. Only then could I convince myself to move on and check the guest room windows. At last, we were safe. I could go back to bed. I turned and started walking back to bed. What if an intruder had broken into the house during the day? My heart beat faster. What if he was hiding under one of the beds? My breathing accelerated. I marched back to the guest room. A small part of me protested. No one could be hiding beneath this bed. The frame was barely 6 inches off the ground, and besides, I had crammed all sorts of junk down there. What if there was a snake? My heart started to pound even harder. I knelt down at the edge of the bed, convinced that something terrible was hiding just behind the bed skirt. If I looked, it would surely kill me, but if I did not look, it might kill Pippa instead. I took a deep breath and lifted the bed skirt. No snakes, no fantastical creatures from horror movies. I finally crawled back into bed, terrified of waking Pippa or Nathan. Neither stirred. Utterly exhausted, I fell asleep before my thoughts could rouse me out of bed. 14, 15, 16, oh no, 17. There were 17 steps. Not 16, a beautiful number that could be divided into two halves of 8 steps each, or bliss, 4 quarters of 4 steps each. And not 18, which at least had the decency to be an even number, but 17, 17 odd-numbered steps. How could my parents have possibly thought this was a good place to live? I was 19 years old, home from college on spring break. My parents had bought a townhouse in a gated community. It was built on top of a hill, so the ground floor was also the top floor. A flight of stairs descended to the second floor, where my siblings and I would sleep. A flight of stairs with 17 impossibly odd steps that would torment me every time I needed to go to a different floor. I experimented with ways to make the 17-step staircase feel like an even number. I tried skipping a step, but no matter what skip I stepped, skipped. I knew the 17th step was there. Stepping on the same stair twice also felt wrong. I tried rushing down the stairs without counting, but not counting felt even worse than counting an odd number. Counting stairs was one of my quirks. I had a few others. Turning jumbles of letters on license plates into words, folding laundry in certain ways, counting how many cars I passed when I was in the faster-moving lane of traffic. But they were just innocuous mind games that made me smile. I freely told friends and family about my little games with a sense of pride. They were proof that I was unique and marching to my own beat. It never occurred to me that these quirks were more than just games, that they were actually a way of exerting control over my world. It never occurred to me that I was flirting with obsessive-compulsive disorder, or that my quirks could turn into something sinister if given the right circumstances. I'm going to bed. Nathan glanced up from his laptop. He likes to piddle with various sports-themed games while watching television. Good night, sweetheart. It was not even 9 o'clock, but at 2.5 months postpartum, I felt like a shell of my former self. The sooner I got to bed, the better chance I had of getting a full night's rest and feeling like an actual human being. I tiptoed into the bedroom, careful not to disturb Pippa. I got into bed and closed my eyes. Were the doors locked? My eyes popped back open. I listened. Nathan was still in the next room watching television and playing games on his computer. I had to check the locks, but he would think it was weird if I started locking and unlocking the doors. I'd have to start with the front door, which was on the other side of the house. The television volume would drown out the sound effects. It took me a few minutes to convince myself the front door was locked. Now it was time for the back door. I sauntered into the den. Nathan's eyes were on the television. I sidled a few steps toward the back door. The back door was technically in the same room as the television, but thanks to the position of the couch, it felt like the back door was part of a separate little mudroom. Nathan was not looking at me. I sidled closer and felt a thrill, as if I was riding a bike down a steep hill. I was there, close enough to touch the back door, and he had not noticed me. I started to lock and relock the door surreptitiously. Nathan kept watching television. My secret was safe. Or so I thought. Long after my postpartum depression was diagnosed and treated, Nathan and I talked about the way I locked and relocked the doors. He'd been aware of what I was doing, but he thought it was a result of normal new mommy fears. Where he grew up, doors were often left unlocked. No one worried about burglars, and they would have thought you were bonkers if you inquired about local serial killers. But I was a city girl. In my world, doors needed to be locked. At least, that was what he told himself. Maybe he was also in denial. It could have been much easier to think his wife was being a bit silly than to confront the possibility that she was swimming in dark psychological waters. Besides, Nathan knew only that I was checking the doors before bed. He did not know I was checking Pippa's breathing throughout the night, or that I checked the stovetop burners, windows, closets, under the beds, and sometimes even inside the washing machine, or that I rechecked the doors and everything else after every breastfeeding session. Those things happened only when he was fast asleep. My anxiety sometimes seemed to have a mind of its own, like my anxiety knew that it had to be surreptitious and not arouse my husband's suspicion. Otherwise, he might have taken me to a doctor, and the doctor might have helped me, and my suffering might not have lasted as long as it did. So that brings us to the end of Chapter 7 and today's installment of my memoir, which is available over on Amazon. And if you're listening and enjoying the book, and when you finish, I would love it if you'd leave a review over on Amazon or Goodreads. Reviews help people find the book and help them decide that they actually should read the book. And so it could be an act of advocacy on your behalf. And you never know what woman out there you might be helping who needs to read my book to understand her own experience and process it in recovery. Thank you for listening. In our next installment, Chapter 8, we will be hearing about my experiences and adventures with insomnia.